Stay focused. It's important work. Fight for your cause. And people will take notice. Success will ensue. Money will ensue. As long as you didn't make that your goal. That this is the way pharmaceutical companies did business. You just substitute the company name and the drug name and the type of injury. But the processes and the procedures and the nastiness and the deceit and the lies and the fraud is all there. The pharmaceutical industry, it is replete in.
Welcome to Trial Lawyer View, the podcast dedicated to the fierce yet compassionate lawyers who fight every day for justice in the courtroom. Our guests are top trial lawyers and their firms who share their stories and experiences, offering valuable insights into their journey, as well as expert guests who provide actionable strategies and practical tips for personal injury lawyers looking to optimize their operations, enhance client service, and drive growth in their practices. Trial Lawyer View is brought to you by Synergy. At Synergy, we aren't just a service provider. We are a strategic partner for personal injury law firms, seamlessly integrating with law firms to boost efficiency from day one. Outsourcing cumbersome administrative tasks like lien resolution and Medicare compliance to an expert partner like Synergy enables personal injury firms to focus on what they do best.
Welcome to another episode of Trial Lawyer View, where I'm joined by the one and only Troy Rafferty. Troy is a widely renowned trial lawyer and shareholder at Rafferty, Dominick, Cunningham, and Yoffa, with nearly 30 years of experience in handling complex mass tort litigation. Recognized for securing some of the largest verdicts and settlements in history, including multi-million dollar awards in testosterone replacement therapy cases and the $36 billion opioid settlement, Troy's built a reputation as one of the nation's leading advocates for victims harmed by defective drugs and products. His expertise spans all phases of mass tort litigation, from trial work to strategic settlement negotiations, making him a sought-after leader in the space. Beyond his extraordinary legal career, Troy has demonstrated a strong commitment to social justice, securing historic settlements for survivors of abuse and advocating for legislative change. As a passionate philanthropist and leader, he has contributed significantly to both his community and the legal profession, holding leadership roles in organizations like the Florida Justice Association. Troy's unparalleled experience and dedication to the law make him a valuable voice for attorneys looking to diversify their practices and take on mass tort litigation. Today, we explore everything that is mass torts and Troy's unique insights from 30 years of practice in the space. Troy, welcome to Trial Lawyer View, and thank you for being with me today on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Jason. I appreciate it. This is all important stuff that I want to make sure everybody has information on.
That's why I'm so excited about the episode today, because you are the first mass tort lawyer to be on the podcast, and I think it's really crucial, some of the information that you talked about it during our recent webinar, the Peak Practice webinar that you were on. And that's kind of, you know, why I thought having you on the podcast would be great for other lawyers to understand all the nuances about getting into the mass tort practice. And I wanted to start out by asking a little bit about your background, because you've been a driving force in some of the largest mass tort cases and the country's history. And I'm curious about what initially drew you to the mass tort space, and how do you decide which cases to take on in such a very complex and competitive field?
Well, I think the question really is, you know, twofold. One, what got me interested in it? And then two, what kept me in it? Because that's pretty much what I've done for 30 years now, which seems like forever. But you know, initially I got involved in it because, you know, there was this a specific client, and I realized visiting this client in the hospital that this was not a unique situation. This involved, quite frankly, this was 30 years ago, involving a claim involving Resilin and a liver failure. And then my client was in the hospital and having a liver transplant. And I started looking into the cause of it and exploring exactly what was it that resulted in this man being in this hospital bed. And when you started looking at it, you could tell it was the medication Resulin, and it was widely prescribed for type 2 diabetes. And as I started looking at it, I realized, you know, I could, we need to do something here. We need to make a difference, not obviously in this client's life, but also we have a tool through the mass tort world and through the procedures and processes set out in the federal statutes and regulations to remedy this from a society standpoint. In that particular case, the drug caused liver failure, and they never explained or told or warned anybody about liver failure. And so I guess that was kind of one of the impetuses. I mean, I did work in FenFen, I did work in breast implant, I've done work in asbestos, all of those. But that kind of really sunk my teeth into, you know, sitting in a hospital room. That's one of the things I want to encourage everybody to do. Get to know your clients. It's so important for a number of reasons. Number one, just personally, you know, many of my clients are some of the most interesting people I've ever met. But you got to get to know them, and you got to go to their homes, and you got to talk to them and get to know them. And so I got to know this gentleman, and it was eye-opening. And then as I got into the litigation, Jason, then it became clear to me that this was an epidemic, that this is the way pharmaceutical companies did business. And over the last 30 years and the dozens and dozens of different pharmaceutical cases that I've handled, the fact of the matter is, it's all the same. You just substitute the company name and the drug name and the type of injury. But the processes and the procedures and the nastiness and the deceit and the lies and the fraud is all there. The pharmaceutical industry, it is replete in.
Well, you know, it's the accountability function that trial lawyers serve, holding those to account for injuries they cause. It's an incredible thing that the profession does to protect everybody.
It's interesting because, you know, one of the things about mass torts is we are uniquely positioned to be and to exercise the function of being a watchdog for our society, just as a whole. And then and when you boil it down to the pharmaceutical industry and all of the drug cases that I've handled over the years, what keeps me coming back to it and what just makes me not want to retire, a lot of people have asked me why I don't retire. And the reality is that this is important work. It's very important work. And it's important for the clients. It's important for society. And the societal change that I've seen unfold in many litigations, whether it's, you know, opioids, for example, the opioid epidemic. I mean, there's not one executive that walked into a courtroom as a criminal defendant. There was not one perp walk done. There was not one conviction of any executives for the mass murders that these pharmaceutical companies engaged in. And getting to, for example, the gadolinium litigation. Let me use that as an example, because that's an extreme example. So I was lead counsel in the gadolinium MDL. And for those that are watching, gadolinium is a gadolinium-based contrast agent. So if anybody's had an MRI, they go in, they get an injection. That's the contrast that shows that helps the doctor see the injuries. But the problem is that they were marketing this, and it was such an important flagship in this particular case for the company. From a profit standpoint, they were putting it in everybody. And this one particular gadolinium-based contrast agent was defective in terms of the way they designed it. They designed it so the chelate, the protective coating around the stuff they're injecting you with, would dissolve so fast that the gadolinium, that is a poison, that is not supposed to be in your body, wouldn't get excreted out your urine. And so it would deposit in the lungs and in your various organs. Basically turn you to stone, Jason. I mean, literally, this was a disease that slowly turned people into stone. Couldn't move, couldn't breathe. Eventually it gets in your lungs and you can't even breathe. And it's fatal and there's no cure for it. It's called nephrogenic systemic fibrosis. But here's the interesting part. Once we exposed the fact that they were selling this and marketing it and being put into people with kidney disease or kidney failure or kidney insufficiency, what would happen is the kidneys would not excrete the gadolinium-based contrast agent soon enough. The weakness of the molecule would break apart. The poison is then depositing into your skin, into your organs. So we were successful in that litigation in many regards, but one of which was they had to actually put a warning on the label that said, do not give to people with renal insufficiency, essentially. I'm shortcutting everything. But the fact of the matter is they put the warning on it. Doctors realized this should not be going on. And as a result, it is not given to patients with kidney disease. And as a result of that, guess what? Nephrogenic systemic fibrosis no longer exists. I mean, an entire disease, which was man-made, this disease was man-made. It doesn't exist outside of gadolinium-based contrast agents. That's the reason it exists, NSF. That disease is gone. I mean, think about that. A fatal disease being thrust upon all these innocent victims, and now it's gone. And why? Because the trial lawyers were able to basically expose this fraud, expose what was going on. And so that kind of thing keeps me coming back. It's about society. It's about societal change. All cases are important. There's no question, Jason. I mean, every case I have is important. But there's something about working on a case that you know is not just going to change one life, but make this world, and I'm not being overly dramatic, make this world a better place for everybody. NSF is just one example of that. Opioids is another example of that. I'm very proud of the work we did in opioids, not just from a financial standpoint and getting compensation for all the cities and counties and first responders and everybody that was part of that or is part of that because it's still going on. But some of the stuff that we were able to do in terms of equitable relief, the increase in the number of first responders, the fact that first responders now carry Narcan at the expense of the pharmaceutical industry, all of these different things, expanding the number of rehabilitation beds, hospital beds, rehabilitation facilities, services, all of those things are so important. And as a result, we're seeing real movement in solving this opioid epidemic throughout our country. So that's what keeps me coming back. It's about societal change. At some point, I'm going to sit down, as everybody here that's listening is going to sit down with their grandchildren at some point in your life, and your grandchild is going to ask you what you did for a living. What did you do, dad, granddad, or grandma? And I want to be able to turn to that child and explain that I made a difference in society, that I change the way things work. You know, one of the things I always tell young lawyers, you know, there's always that saying that all us lawyers love, and that is, if the law isn't with you, you know, go with the facts. If the facts aren't with you, go with the law. And if neither are with you, pound the table. You know, that kind of stuff. But the reality is you have to think outside the box to effectuate change. Everybody's afraid of change. And to effectuate change, You have to really dive into what it is that you believe in and what it is that makes a difference in your life and others. And that will get you up in the morning. That will drive you. That will give you the success that you need.
Well, you answered the question I was going to ask anyway, so perfect. You helped me out there. I didn't have to ask the question. But I am curious, because you were talking about the opioid litigation and the settlement and the billions of dollars that were paid. I'm curious, because of what you do, how you develop strategies and tactics to go after these behemoths that you're facing. I mean, I imagine in the opioid litigation, just from knowing what I know, that you are dealing with companies that have vast, vast resources to fight. And you are fighting for the little guy. How do you go about that task? Because it seems like a monumental task.
There's not one simple answer to that. You go at it like you would any other case. And you can't let yourself be intimidated. So being in the mass tort world, being in the mass tort sector, you have to have courage because you are going up against the biggest companies. It truly is a David and Goliath situation that we find ourselves as mass tort lawyers in. Because they can outspend us. I don't care how much money. You combine all the money of every trial lawyer in the country. They're still going to be able to outspend you. That's just how big they are. The pharmaceutical industry, as we talked about, Jason, is over a $700 billion a year industry. $700 billion. I mean, we're nearing a trillion. Just 25 years ago, it was about $145 billion a year industry. I mean, think about that. Now, what's changed? Marketing. That's what changed. Marketing. The internet. Them being able to get to you. We're only one of a couple countries in the world that allow direct-to-consumer advertising of pharmaceuticals. And as a result, the pharmaceutical industry runs ads. Testosterone replacement therapy. I tried several of those cases. TRT, as it's referred to, was kind of marketed as a fountain of youth. You know, take the, you're over 50 and you're kind of overweight and you are tired more lethargic and you don't have as big a sex drive. Oh, take TRT and, you know, you'll be 20 again. None of which was true. None of which was proven at all. And yet it still goes out on the market. They advertise the hell out of it, get thousands and thousands and thousands of American men to put this drug in their body. And all it does is put at-risk patients at higher risk for heart attacks and strokes. That's all it does. One case I tried, Jason, involved a middle-aged man, obese, high cholesterol, high blood pressure, smoker. But you know what? He had all of what their little check boxes were, over 50, was tired in the afternoons, you know, less sex drive, blah, 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 blah. Everybody has that. And the reality is, yeah, everybody out there that's a man that's watching this over 50 says, yeah, Troy, you're right. But the fact of the matter is, this was never proven to change any of those things because the body naturally decreases your testosterone level as you age. Why? The body is a magnificent machine. And it knows as you get older, you become at more risk for heart attacks and strokes. And just through the aging process and life. And what the body does is makes up for that. It compensates for that by reducing testosterone in your body because testosterone does two things, Jason. It increases the stickiness of your blood and the thickness of it, both of which increase clots. If you have a clot, you have a heart attack or a stroke. I mean, it's that simple. And so they're pumping this drug because it became, for them, something that was a $50 million a year business because it was supposed to be the FDA approved testosterone replacement therapy for a very specific purpose. And I'm sorry if I'm going into too much detail, but it's literally a good example of the pharmaceutical industry at work. What they did is they marketed it to these people. It was not approved for this use. It was not approved for this demographic or this patient. Yet they convinced the doctors that they should be prescribing it. The doctors prescribed it. And as a result, thousands of heart attacks and strokes were caused.
You know, the upshot of it all is, though, even though they've got all these dollars and they make all this money bringing these drugs that can be dangerous to the population of market, you figure out ways to drive them to their knees and ultimately make change.
Well, the way we do that, though, Jason, is through their own conduct and their own comments. The way we get to them is by getting into their file cabinets, by going into the basement of Pfizer, where I have been in New York City, and looking at their documents. Back in the old days before technology, that's the way we had to do it. I'd get on a plane, I'd fly to New York, I'd go to Pfizer's headquarters, they'd put me in a basement, and I would go through box after box after box for months, okay? But that's what you have to do. You know, the question, the old saying, the integrity of a man is measured by how he acts when he thinks people aren't watching, okay? The pharmaceutical company is no different. What they do, what they put out there in the public and to the FDA is much different than what they're saying internally. It's amazing when you put two pieces of paper, what they sent to the FDA and what the conversations were inside the company at that same time, and how starkly different they are. And, you know, that's so you ask how we go about strategizing. We use their own conduct and their own documents. You know, when the vice president of a pharmaceutical company, and this happened too, you know, they throw a party. They're discontinuing one drug that is killing people and relaunching a new drug that is going to kill people. And what they do, so for the one that they're retiring, they throw this $1 million-plus party, a fake funeral for this drug. Now, this was an opioid manufacturer. And I asked him during the deposition, do you think it's right for you to be laughing and drinking and partying at a funeral, at a fake funeral, while thousands of people out there in this country right now, today, as we're talking, are attending real funerals of family, of friends, of loved ones? Do you think that's appropriate to be celebrating this and celebrating it in terms of a funeral when people are dying in the streets, literally dying in the streets, to the point, quite frankly, where morgues throughout this country had to start hiring and buying refrigerated trucks to store the dead opioid bodies that were being scooped up off the streets? Now think about that, Jason. If that's not an epidemic, I don't know what the hell one is. And, you know, and for them to be throwing parties, now they would never tell anybody that they threw that party. I found out about that party by going through their documents and finding a budget that was laid out that included rappers, illusionists, magicians, a bubbleologist. I didn't even know what the hell a bubbleologist was, but they paid $50,000 or some outrageous amount for a bubbleologist to be there. They had step dancers. They had bagpipers. They had a casket for the funeral for this drug. Now, if that's not cold and that doesn't give you a glimpse into the mentality of this industry, then I don't know what does.
Very poor taste. Well, I wanted to do a little deep dive on something that you talked about during the webinar, which is trial lawyers that are looking to diversify their practice, getting into the mass tort space. But specifically, how can a smaller or solo practitioner begin to incorporate mass tort into their practice? And what initial steps would you recommend that they take to be successful in that endeavor?
Well, first of all, I want everybody to know that the mass tort specialty is available to everybody. I think a lot of people have this thing in their mind where they're like, well, I'm not a mass tort lawyer and I don't know anything about the mass tort world. It's just a matter of time and commitment to understanding the processes and procedures, just like you would with any other case that walks in. But the one thing that is necessary is, really, I'd say two things. One, courage. The courage to do something different and to get outside your norm and think outside the box. And that takes courage. So number one, figure out whether or not you've got the fortitude to withstand what you're going to be faced with. And two, I would say patience. Because this is not something you just go pay somebody, you know, $100,000 and ask for a bunch of cases and get them sent to you and you warehouse them. That's not what the mass tort world is. And so you got to be patient. You have to pick your project and pick it smartly. Pick it so that it fits your current situation for your firm. Not all projects, even though they may be good projects in terms of the type of case, in terms of the societal harm that's been caused, but it might not fit your firm at that time. So find a project that means something to you in your heart, and then figure out whether or not it fits financially and resource-wise in your firm at the time. But be patient. Don't just jump in and decide. I've seen this happen. One particular small law firm that I know of did not take my advice and jumped full gun immediately into this one mass tort, put all their resources. They were a small firm. The entire office was focused on that one project. It went on for years. We won a lot of trials. We won a lot of motions. All in all, a very successful litigation, except that after all of that, the court, the appellate court, took it away from us, the whole thing away from us under Daubert. And there was a lot of politics involved in that. But anyway, but it was the right fight. It was a good fight. We changed lives. We changed society. We changed the way that company did business. But unfortunately, from a financial standpoint, as an attorney, it's not going to result in anything. And so that firm went out of business. I mean, because they did exactly what I'm telling you not to do. And that is, don't jump in and put all your eggs in one basket and all your resources. Do it slow and gradual. I mean, it took me 30 years to get to where I am. It's not a snap your finger overnight, you're a mass tort lawyer and you're doing all these things. It takes time, gradual. I would also figure out if there's a case that's going on right now that you're interested in, whether it be Depo Provera or PFAS or Ozempic or insulin, whatever the case may be, figure that out. Figure out, and if you want to start working on MDLs or in mass torts, you can do it. Many lawyers in this space make money by just working the cases at the MDL level. There's always work to be done. Documents are produced to us in staggering amounts. I think in the opioid litigation, we had probably 200 or 300 million pages of documents at least. I mean, think about that, 200 or 300 million. What they're hoping, their job is to hide it in a haystack, that one document. Our job is to find it. And quite frankly, that's some of the fun. That's some of the fun part. It's the hunt. As Sherlock Holmes would say, the game is afoot. But it's fun too. But you can get involved. There's always work to be done in MDLs and in mass torts. And start gradually incorporating yourself. Set up meetings. I'm happy to meet with anybody. Anybody that's listening out there that wants to get in the mass tort world, you can reach out to me at pvglaw.com. And I'll be happy just to consult with you to tell you what I think you should do or shouldn't do and why. And you can make your decisions. But I'm happy to be here as a consultant. As I think most seasoned mass tort attorneys are.
So you just gave a cautionary tale of a risk, which I think is something that is a deterrent. So to trial lawyers, what advice would you give to a trial lawyer who's hesitant to enter the mass tort space because of that risk, because of the complexity? How do they find the confidence to get started?
I think the way to get started is in small bites. Or, you know, every great journey starts with the first step. And the reality is the first step is to say, I want to do it. I want to do something different. One of the things, and I lecture on this quite a bit, Jason, about habits, trial lawyer habits. We tend to, like baseball players, we tend to be superstitious and we tend to have habits, whether they're good habits or bad habits. But one of the things that I always tell people is habits, while they can be good, they can also be deadly. And you have to be cognizant and always asking yourself, why am I doing this? Why? Is it because this is what my forefathers did, you know, in terms of filing this motion or that motion or doing this or doing this? Fine. Well, ask yourself, why am I doing this? Do I need to? How can I do it differently? You know, to make it better. There's always better ways to do things. So I think one of the things you have to do is start small. Start small. If you want to get into mass torts, look at a case, find out if a case appeals to you. If you've got a case, then start talking to lawyers in the space. That's the first step. You know, what is the process? I've got this case, Ms. Jones out of Sarasota. She took Depo Provera and she has a brain tumor. She has a meningioma. And, you know, then reach out and start incorporating yourself into that. Don't just go jump in and say, oh, well, I've got this one case, so I'm going to go get 1,000. Don't do that. Because that's the big thing that lawyers, especially smaller firms wanting to get in the mass tort business, unfortunately, they kind of jump in too fast, too soon, and that's when they're lost. So take your time. Team up with a firm that's been doing it. Okay. There's, I mean, every mass tort law firm out there that's been doing this for a long time would be happy and eager to assist, to help, to co-counsel, to help you along. I know we are at RDCY, and, you know, that's the thing you have to do. So you're talking first steps, decide whether you want a particular project. If so, get a case in that project and then reach out to other lawyers that are in that field that are doing it. Team up with them.
So we've talked a fair bit already about the complexity and kind of alluded to significant resources needed to litigate a mass tort case. How do you manage volume and scale your operations effectively in this space while also maintaining some type of personalized client interaction that a client, you know, the personal injury victim demands if they're involved in something like this?
I think, once again, that gets back to the gradual nature of getting into mass torts. Okay, start off small. That way you can talk to every client. You can meet with every client. You can get on a plane and go sit in their house, in their living room, and hear their story and get a better understanding for it. But if you team up with another law firm, it makes it much more economical. It makes it much more palatable if you're teamed up with another firm. And then you can, as you proceed through that litigation, see what your shop needs and grow it slowly to be able to maintain the quality of the representation you want, but make it so that you can also effectuate change.
Because the key is your firm has, I mean, I'm sure through your 30 years of experience, figured out some of this complexity and the allocation of resources and client communication and all of those challenges when you're dealing with a mass tort versus a single event practice.
It's easy a lot of times, I think, to fall into this mindset that mass torts is about getting cases and then essentially warehousing them. And that's not what the practice of mass torts is anymore. And, you know, you can't go into it with this notion that, well, I can just get the cases, warehouse them, and then when Troy settles them at the national level, then I'll get paid. That's not the way to approach this. And quite frankly, if that's your angle going into it, then don't. There's room at the table for everybody. And when I say that, I mean everybody that's willing to work and do it the right way. And that's what you have to focus on. And that's what, you know, mentoring, I wouldn't go try a criminal murder case without getting somebody on board with me who's tried murder cases. Okay. I just wouldn't do it. It wouldn't be fair to the client. There's too many different aspects to that particular type of case, just like with mass tort cases. And some of them are geared towards trial. Some of them are geared towards settlement. Some of them are geared towards, you know, equitable relief. It just depends.
So because, you know, a lot of the mass tort work has been in the drug arena, I'm curious, because of the science and expert testimony needed, in any of your recent cases, can you talk about key scientific insights that help ultimately strengthen your arguments? And how do you make sure that your team is leveraging those scientific aspects of these cases? Because I would imagine there's a lot that turns on that.
Mass tort cases are all about science. So if you're not into science, then you probably ought to, you know, stick to whatever it is you're doing. But the science drives much of what happens. For example, that case, the cautionary tale, as you put it, Jason, the cautionary tale case, for example, you need to make sure that you know the science. We knew the science inside and out on that particular case. But like most science, you know, the defendant is always going to say it's open to interpretation, and you got to go through cross-examinations. A lot of times they're pointing out the weaknesses in particular studies that the defense wants to rely upon. But yes, you're right, Jason. It is very scientifically focused. And in that cautionary tale, for example, that's what happened, is that the judge, you know, you get a new judge, new appellate division, and then all of a sudden they're looking at the same thing that the prior judge did, and they're rendering a different decision. And so, you know, you want to always look at the science, the jurisdiction that it's going to be in, the Daubert jurisdiction that it's going to be in. and the appellate court's treatment of Dauber. Because the worst thing that happens is you go, you try, you get the big verdicts and everything else, and you take it up on appeal, and the appellate court takes it away from you. So while you got the verdict, it's just a piece of paper, and now it's worth nothing because of the appellate division. So you have to really take a look. Each circuit has differing views on Daubert and preemption. There's some of these, I would say, benchmark issues that you need to address before deciding to get involved in litigation. The science is a huge part of one. I talk with this in deciding whether or not to take one particular case involving an ADHD drug. A little 11-year-old girl attempted suicide because of this particular drug she was on. And as I was looking into it and deciding whether to take it, you know, I picked up the phone and I called the leading experts at Harvard. You know, I just worked the phones. And you talk to people, you have to talk to the scientists, though. If there's a published paper that comes out, I pick up the phone and I start calling the authors. You know, okay, this doctor out of the Mayo Clinic up in Minnesota. Okay, well, get him on the phone. Ask him about it. Talk to him about it. Understand it. And because walking in blind is no way to practice law. And so, yes, you have to do that. The great way to do it, and I decided to end up taking it. I originally turned the case down, just so you know, Jason, because on first blush, I looked at it and I was like, no, it was an attempted suicide cases. You know, there's all sorts of issues. It was a single pharmaceutical case. It wasn't a mass tort, but it was a mass tort in the sense of, you know, all the discovery was going to be the same, everything. But I decided to take the case after flying down to Orlando, which is where the client lived, and sitting in a conference room with the client and her mother for 8 hours talking with them. And I won't go into the details because we don't have time, but the reality is when I walked out of that conference room, there was no way on God's green earth that I was not taking that case. It was the right thing to do. And yes, it was risky. It was, but you know, luckily I've been blessed with the resources to take on some of those, as many people have been. And that's why I say, if it's a resource standpoint, team up with another firm that's experienced in it. But I took that case, and I talked to all those experts, and it turned out that they were 100% behind me on the theory, on what was happening, on the atrocity of the situation, and it was successful. And as a result, that drug changed its label.
I remember that case. I handled the Medicaid lien reduction on that one, and I that sticks in my mind, that the facts of that case and seeing the result of what occurred, it's one of those that I can't imagine not helping those people.
Oh, yeah. I mean, in one of the other litigations I had, I went to a client's home in Cleveland, Ohio, and went to their home just the scenario was just unbelievable. This woman is turning to stone. It was a gadolinium case. She had very limited mobility. She was in constant pain. And to go to their home and see their home with a blue tarp for a roof, to look at their 20-year-old car that was beat up, that they had to take the passenger seat out in and turn into a bed so that her husband could get her to the doctor, which was an hour and a half drive away. But, you know, you don't really sense that from a human standpoint until you're there, until you're sitting there and you see the pain. I've cried more with clients than anybody in this world. And when you see the pain and the horror and the indignities that people have to suffer all to make sure that the president of Pfizer is able to afford his Armani suits, I mean, come on, give me a break. You know, I doubt that gentleman that threw the funeral party out in Vegas for over $1 million has ever been into a house of someone who's suffering, who doesn't know how they're going to pay their heat, can't repair their roof on their house, and are living in the way they are, and are facing certain death.
That brings me to another question. You did pro bono work in cases on behalf of survivors of the Dozier School of Boys and Okeechobee School for Boys. And I'm curious about your commitment to justice and helping marginalized communities like that. How are you incorporating things like that into your future plans for handling mass tort cases?
I appreciate you bringing that up. The Dozier School, I look down all the time whenever anybody asks me about that because I wear my White House Boys wristband all the time. The White House Boys were the victims, is what they're referred to as, the victims of the Dozier School. The Dozier School was just a school of horror. I mean, it was just, there was a separate building. So it's a reform school. What they would do, and it was open for 100 years. It just closed in 2011. It was open for 100 years. And what they would do is the local police would scoop up kids off the streets, charge them with truancy or smoking a cigarette or minor infractions like that, sentence them to the reform school, the Dozier School. They'd be sent there. And in fact, down south, down here in this area, I mean, many people grew up with the threat from their parents, if you keep acting up, I'm going to send you to Dozier. I mean, that was just it. It was, if you act up, we're sending you to Dozier, because everybody knew the horrors that were going on there. And it was allowed to go on by the state. And what would happen is those kids would be sentenced. And it was not a school at all. There was no schoolwork being done. They would be pulled out of their beds in the morning, and they'd be forced to work in the mill and out in the fields and everything else all day. And then they'd come back, and then at night, the guards would pick a couple of kids out of their beds, take them to this white cinder block house on the ground called the White House. They would take them to the White House, and they used that building. It was a small cinder block house, and they used that building, Jason, for one particular reason, because it quieted the children's screams. It had such a loud exhaust system that when they were beating and raping these children and murdering them, people couldn't hear their screams. And what they did is they had two rape rooms and two beating rooms in that White House. Why? Because you couldn't beat and rape a black kid in the same room that you beat and rape a white kid. Now, think about that for a second, Jason. I mean, that is so telling in so many ways of what is wrong in our society, has been wrong in our society, and needs to change in our society. And so they would take the kids in there, beat them, rape them. They beat them with the same exact tool. It was a wood mallet, 18 inches long, with a leather strap attached to it, with rivets in it, in the leather. So when they whipped them, it would gash their skin and blood would run everywhere. Most kids, when they left the White House, were covered in blood, unable to move. Many died. So far, 52 bodies have been found on the grounds, buried in unmarked graves. It's just horrific. And I went there. I was asked about the case. I went there with some of the victims to the school. Once again, getting back to the importance of being in and really engulfing yourself in the situation. And I went there, stood outside the White House with some of the victims. One particular victim, I said, you have to come on. I'll say his name, Cecil. I said, Cecil, you got to get out. Got to get out of the van and come tell your story. I need to. And I need you to. And he said, Troy, I served three tours in Vietnam. I've crawled through the mud, blood, been shot at, not knowing if I'm going to live one second to the next. And he said, I would rather be back there than be at this school ever again. That tells you the kind of horrors and atrocities that were being thrust upon these children. Children, the people we're supposed to protect the most, you know, the children, the elderly, the disabled, all these people, the most vulnerable in our society, are often the ones that are being taken advantage of. And we have an obligation as people to try and make sure that doesn't happen. So they didn't have a lawsuit, Jason. And getting back to that saying, if the law isn't with you, you go with the facts. If the facts aren't with you, you go with the law. And if neither are with you, you pound the table. Well, if the law's not with you, I change things. I change that saying a little bit. If the law's not with you, change the law. That's what you do. Okay? So when I realized they didn't have a case, you know, I took to the legislature. Let's change the law. Let's make it an actual statute in this state that these people have been abused, they've suffered, and they're entitled to compensation. And we passed that law last year, Jason. I'm very proud of that. In fact, that's probably one of the, and I didn't make a nickel off of it, nor will any lawyer. I made that very clear to all the victims. And when lawyers started calling me after I announced the $20 million, I said, there will be no attorney's fees or expenses paid out in these cases. It's just the right thing to do. They tried for 15 years to get compensation from the legislature. They came and saw me, and we were able to get it done. But that's an example of what thinking outside the box and doing things to change society. And this is what happened to Dozier, by the way, Jason, is happening throughout the country. We've got cases in all sorts of different jurisdictions involving these types of things. These reform schools are incubators for abuse. That's what they are. And there's a great book that Paris Hilton wrote about her experience when her parents sent her away to school and what she went through. It happens all over the country, and it happens to all levels of socioeconomic people. It happens to everywhere. And so, you know, that's the kind of thing that you can just, I mean, it would make me so angry listening to those stories from all of these victims. And, you know, a lot of hugs and a lot of tears later, we were able to get it done. But that alone, being standing next to the governor while he signed that bill, along with some great legislators that helped, and all of the victims, was just, it's something that I'll never be able to explain in words. But I can tell you, I got goosebumps thinking about it right now. And listen, it's the right thing to do. We have a saying here at RDCY, we take on causes, not cases. And by that, I mean, of course, everybody's got a case, and cases are important. But if you look at them not as a case, but as a cause, it gives you a different perspective. It gives you more energy and more emotion and more anger, quite frankly. If you look at it, this is a cause. Whether it be a cause for one client in one accident or whether it's for 10,000 clients because of one drug, you look at it as a cause. We take causes, not cases here.
Well, you've got a great team there. You know, I've got so much respect for Sean, Fred, Greg, worked with all those guys, and they're phenomenal people. Can you talk a little bit about the firm and what led you to the group of lawyers that you get to practice with?
In terms of the practice, there's one thing I'm certain of, and that is complacency kills. Being complacent kills in every aspect of your life. Never become complacent. That's getting back to our conversation about habits. Ask yourself about the habits, because sometimes you get into a rut in the practice of law where you're just going through the motions. Okay, client comes in, they're injured in an auto wreck, do the intake, you request the medical records, you send a demand, you file the lawsuit, you settle it, or you try it. It gets to be habitual and not energizing and not creative. Complacency kills creativity. It does. And so don't be complacent. And in terms of my move personally, after 30 years of building Levin Papantonio Rafferty, I hate to say it, but I wanted a challenge. I wanted a new challenge in my life and in my career. And the opportunity presented itself with some of the finest lawyers I've been able to work with for the last 30 years. And I've worked with Sean and Fred for 30 years. I've worked with Greg for many years. And I got to tell you, being like-minded, surround yourself with, number one, people who are smarter than you. They're all smarter than me here. That's okay. I'm smart enough to know I'm not all that smart. But, you know, the reality is you surround yourself with smart people people who are smarter than you that push you and that you enjoy being around and that you, you know, it's somewhat of a cliche, but there's nobody I'd rather be in a foxhole with than Sean Dominick, you know, Fred Cunningham, Greg Yaffa. You know, they're a firm that very much wants to do and, you know, wanted to do Mass Torts. And so I came on board and we are just, you know, I got to tell you, the challenge and the creativity that is spurred as a result of the change has been magnificent, just magnificent. And that's what I want people, don't focus on the potential negative aspects of change. Focus on the positive aspects of it. Because it's very important. And you know what? If you just care and you just cling to what you believe in, success will come. There's a great quote from Viktor Frankl I talked about in the presentation. You know, success cannot be pursued. It must ensue. And it only does so as the unintended side effect of giving yourself up to a cause greater than yourself. Now think about that. Give yourself up to a cause greater than yourself, and then success will follow. You can't chase success. Success will come if you give yourself to a cause. And you say, you know what? I'm going to make this right.
So a couple more questions. Your last comments kind of lead into what I was going to ask you about. As a bit of an elder statesman, and I'm right there with you on this, being elderly.
We grew up together.
Yeah, exactly. But having the experience you have as a Mass Tort lawyer, what advice would you give to young attorneys looking to build a career in Mass Tort litigation and take on these complex, high-stake cases?
Be courageous, be patient, be bold, be smart. I guess all those are easier said than done. But if you go into it with a systematic approach instead of a gunslinger approach, it is going to bring you and your practice to a different platitude than you've ever experienced before. It's a different mindset. It's a different atmosphere in your office because everybody knows what you're dealing with is societal change. We're going to change things. If they say it can't be done, you have to ask yourself before you get into this, if they say it can't be done, are you the type of person that says, okay? Or are you the person that says, to hell with that? Watch. Watch what I can do. And figure out a way creatively to get around whatever obstacle you're facing, whether it's in the practice of law or life.
Great advice. So, final question. Always ask it. Since the podcast is Trial Lawyer Review, this is open-ended. You can talk about whatever you want, maybe something I didn't ask you. What's your view as one of the preeminent Mass Tort lawyers in the country?
Wow, that is just giving me the mic, isn't it? thanks, Jason. Listen, I think one of the things I want to emphasize to people is the importance of what we do. And everybody out there that's listening to this has a superpower. And that superpower is the ability to make wrongs right. And the mission you have as lawyers is to figure out how, what wrong it is you want to right, and then go about doing it. And one of the things that I want to emphasize to everyone is kind of an offshoot of that, the whole Viktor Frankl success issue. And that is, don't worry about money or success or fame or anything else. Worry about your cause, the cause you're fighting. Stay solely focused on that. Don't worry about how many hits I'm getting on, you know, social media for, you know, this particular broadcast or that. Hopefully somebody gets something out of what I've just said, you know, over the last several, you know, minutes. But the fact of the matter is, just stay focused. It's important work. It's critical work. And it'll make you feel reinvigorated. I mean, I don't know how many people get excited anymore to have a new client meeting with a person who's suffered whiplash from a rear-end auto accident. Okay? I mean, those are important cases. Those are good cases. They're necessary. But my point is that when you find yourself, I got to go through this again, I got to do this again and again, that's when you really need to reevaluate your practice. You need to reevaluate yourself and put yourself in a situation that you're uncomfortable in. Show up at a hearing where there's 25 lawyers and you don't know any of them. And go in there and fight for your cause. And people will take notice. Success will ensue. Money will ensue. And just as long as you didn't make that your goal.
Great advice. So if anyone listening to the podcast today wants to work with you and your firm, Rafferty Dominic Cunningham and Yoffa, what's the best way to connect with you?
You can go on to pbglaw.com or you can contact me directly at troy@pbglaw.com or reach out to me. I have no problem giving out my cell number. You know, it's 850-698-2572. 850-698-2572. You can call me anytime. I'm a 24/7 guy, and so if you need anything, if you have a question and you think it's a stupid question, I don't care. Call me. I'm happy to answer it for you.
Troy, I appreciate the gift of your time today. Thank you for being with me, and we'll see everybody on the next episode of Trial Lawyer Review.
Absolutely. Thanks, Jason. You're doing great work, man.
Here is another episode of Trial Lawyer View. We hope you enjoy today's guest and discussion. Tune in to our next episode for more helpful insights from fellow trial lawyers and practice experts. This podcast is brought to you by Synergy. Visit partnerwithsynergy.com to learn more about how Synergy can free your firm to focus on what it does best.